This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the PTVN Rewind Series. I'm Ben Morse talking No Way Out 2007 with Glenn Butler, Graham Cawthon, Dan McGinn. We already covered the Hornswoggle Little Boogeyman stuff in the first part, so I don't know if we'll get back to that. We probably will. Glenn, do you have more to say on that?
I'll have more to say when we do the Rewind for Great American Bash 07.
Okay. So we're on deck for Great American Bash 07. More to talk about there. But we're headed into the final two matches of this show. There's a huge main event, but before we get there, there was, I'm not going to call it the co-main event, but definitely the semi-main, and that's that SmackDown, which was promoting the show, brought in Bobby Lashley, who was a few months removed from being on SmackDown. At this point, he's the ECW champion. Or as they note, and this was interesting to me, they made a big deal around this time of always saying the ECW world champion. That would change later in the year to just ECW champion, as it was not. But they were really making a push at this point to establish ECW as a third brand on par with Raw and SmackDown. So Lashley is competing on a SmackDown pay-per-view, defending the ECW world title against Mr. Kennedy. The match gets a early jump start when Kennedy is giving a backstage interview and with Crystal, who I still want to talk about, but we'll save that.
No.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Crystal, Graham. It's happening. But Mr. Kennedy's giving an interview. Seems a little lost, I'll be honest. Just kind of stumbling through an interview. Lashley interrupts him. They fight, stare down. We get a very big video package on Lashley, touting his time in the military, his amateur wrestling credential. We get interviews with his family. Basically, WWE is not being subtle about the fact that this is the guy they want to be their next John Cena, their next big star. I think we all got that sense from late 2006, 2007. ECW essentially became Bobby Lashley's playground to be put over as the next A-list WWE guy. A month after this, he would be in the Battle of the Billionaires. But here, he has a 15-minute match with Mr. Kennedy, a lot of it revolving around Mr. Kennedy working Lashley's leg and Lashley showing whether or not he can sell the leg. And then weird finish where Kennedy brings a chair into the ring and the ref has been bumped. I believe it was Mickey Henson, the ECW referee at this point, who used to be WCW referee Mickey J, gets bumped but doesn't really do a great job selling the bump, in that he turns around every few seconds to see Kennedy about to swing the chair and then mysteriously like gets something as an eye and doesn't see Kennedy swing the chair. Eventually, Lashley gets the chair from Kennedy, waffles him. Mickey Henson sees it, DQs Lashley. So Kennedy wins the match, but not the title by disqualification. There's a lot to talk about here, from the finish to how Lashley was being promoted to, in general, did Lashley deserve the push he was getting? Dan, as the guy who was outside at this point, and you probably missed, I'm assuming, Bobby Lashley's WWE run. Of course, he's in TNA now as their champ. But what did you think of Bobby Lashley here? Did you buy that this is a guy who could have been a main event star? Were you into the push?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the guy looked like a million bucks. Like, it looked like if I didn't really, I mean, we didn't really see a any type of interview or anything. But I was thinking, if, as long as this guy could talk, this is the type of guy that's a prototype of what Vince and the company wants to see. You know, the muscle bound, you know, guy who can move a little bit, and he's a guy that belongs on the billboard or belongs on the poster with the belt, holding the belt aloft or holding it on his shoulder. He looked like a guy who was going to be the guy, in my opinion. Just because of the way the roster was set up, he was on the third tier show, but he was on top of that third tier show, and he was a big guy. I mean, he was probably what they were hoping would be like the next Brock Lesnar, perhaps, or somebody that was going to be competing for the title, if not holding it, chasing it. And it was just a question of, well, when would his time come? You know, at the moment you had the Cenas and you had your Undertaker. Shawn Michaels was in the mix. Triple H gets hurt, but he's, you know, still around. But I'm just watching him now, just in the background, as with watching WrestleMania 23. He has that belt. He has that look. He has that kind of it factor that, you know, initially while watching, you think, well, why didn't it happen now so many years later? But in looking at this match, it was just an odd pairing, because you had like kind of the cross promotion, one on SmackDown, one on ECW, and they were two guys that they looked like they were trying to push. So you kind of were in that corner of, well, who loses in this situation? But looking at Lashley, yeah, I could definitely see what the appeal was, just on the look of him, not so much the other stuff that goes into it.
Graham, just as far as the match itself, breaking down the 15 minutes we saw here, which was definitely, you know, a long match, it definitely a semi main event match. What did you think of the match itself? These two guys, how they worked together, did they show that they were ready to be in this position? What did you think of what went on in the ring?
Well, I think one guy came across as natural and one guy did not. The guy that came across as natural was Kennedy. The guy that did not was Lashley. I thought the match was fine, but went too long. And then there was a little downtime period where you can actually hear the crowd start to turn on them a little bit. Mm-hmm. I thought Kennedy, his pre-match promo was fantastic. He's at this point the heel that you're kind of rooting for, because he's so entertaining to listen to and to watch in the ring. He's got such a presence about him, whereas Lashley at this point did not. He was just more of a, I'm a military veteran, I'm a amateur wrestler, and I'm a big dude, and I'm going to throw you around, which is good. And you can get some mileage out of that, but it's hard to without him being more personable, without him coming across on the microphone as more natural, it's hard to really build on the guy. And at this point, they were looking to really, you know, get everyone on board the Bobby Lashley bandwagon, to the point where, looking back on the show, he kind of comes across as, you know, maybe a modern day Roman Reigns. Not in look, not in persona, but in, this is our guy. This is the company guy.
We're all in on this guy.
We're going to get completely behind him, whether you want us to or not.
Right. Yeah, no, I think it's a reasonable comparison. I mean, I think there's definitely differences between them, and we can bet how ready they both were and stuff like that. But yeah, it's definitely, this was definitely a guy who, Lashley was never a guy who at this point in his career, I don't think the fans got behind him and WWE said, oh, the fans like him, we should push him. This was definitely a guy who WWE decided to push. Some of the fans got behind him, but that was because, you know, the PR machine was behind him full press. And as you mentioned, Graham, Kennedy and Dan as well, Kennedy wasn't chopped liver either at this point. You know, again, JBL hammering home the point of all the world champions he's beaten. Very strong push on for him. Both of these guys seemed like they were headed for big things. Lashley, Battle of the Billionaires, had a big spring feuding with Vince McMahon himself, was basically hand-groomed, and ended up, it's ironic that he was compared to Brock Lesnar by Dan, because he ended up doing essentially the same thing and leaving WWE because he felt the grind was too hard and kind of soured Vince on trusting a lot of people. Kennedy, injury-prone, would have a lot of trouble. They're both in TNA today. Glenn, what happened with these guys? Why did they not succeed in WWE? And again, just as we asked in the first match with MVP, is there something that could have been done differently, or was this just destined to be kind of a misfire?
I think what could have been done differently for Lashley might have been to go a little slower with his push. I think he was doing really well on SmackDown in 2006 when he won the U.S. title. He was in the King of the Rings tournament and fought Booker. I thought he had a good match with Booker, which not a lot of people were doing in 2006. I think that he was on a good trajectory, and then they kind of blew it up to make ECW the Bobby Lashley show. And you can do that if you want. You can put the machine behind him and do the big push if you want, but you've got to be smart about it. If you want to make him Brock Lesnar, then the thing that made Brock Lesnar work was Paul Heyman. Because like Lesnar, Lashley couldn't talk at all. I mean, they sold him as soft-spoken, which is an understatement. But
soft-spoken,
you know,
hard-hitting.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing was that he was Lesnar was a heel, and he was coming in and he was decimating people, and he was just violent and brutal. And they're selling Lashley as this sort of big, brutish face, which, again, you can do, but you've got to be smart about it. And he really, he needed a manager. This was a point in time when they didn't have managers pretty much at all. So kind of blowing up his trajectory was not a smart thing to do. Kennedy, I think, like Lashley, is a person who did better in small doses. And so when this match started to stretch on a little bit with the long segment with Kennedy attacking Lashley's leg, which, I mean, his sort of, he did sort of a modified figure four, which was kind of cool. And Lashley's selling, I think, was fine. But it just drove the match on, and the crowd was not getting into it. The crowd really was sitting on their hands for a lot of it, and then moved over into distinct antipathy later on. And the finish didn't help anything. But as to what went wrong with Lashley, I think that was too much too soon. They could have gone slower there. With Kennedy, it's a little different because they didn't jam him into a main event role right away. They gave him Money in the Bank, but then they set him up as sort of a long-term Money in the Bank holder like Edge, where he would kind of grow into the role before assuming it.
Right.
Which obviously didn't work because 2007 was Injury City across the company.
Yeah.
Which kind of blew up a little.
City as well.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So that kind of got blown up too. So that might be more happenstance for Kennedy.
It's funny going back to Lashley, a lot of the stuff you said with Lashley, you know, we always give TNA a hard time for copying WWE or not doing things right. But one of the few things they've really nailed was they handled Lashley the exact way you just suggested. They made him a heel. They made him a monster, and they gave him MVP as his voice, his talker. And he probably had the best year of his career last year as their world champion.
Yeah, and he actually had a pretty good run with their title.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was having – I caught a couple of his matches with Austin Aries, and they were, you know, pretty good.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was being booked exactly how you said he should have been, which is just a monster destroyer. And, yeah, it worked well. Hey, going back to another thing you said about, you know, they had him on a good trajectory. He won the U.S. title. He was a small cog on SmackDown. He could have, in time, grown to be a star for the company. What that brings around is how WWE was using ECW at this point. Because at this point, ECW is almost in its second incarnation as its own brand. It started as a revival of Extreme Championship Wrestling. At this point, they're trying to make it a viable third brand. It'll eventually grow into what I really liked, which was kind of just like developmental plus. It was almost like a precursor to NXT. But at this stage, are they using ECW the right way as like kind of a, you know, we got a guy like Lashley. He's a young guy. We don't want him on top of SmackDown or Raw, but we can let him dominate ECW and go over, you know, the tests of the world and kind of build him up. Or was that the wrong way to use ECW? Was ECW just, you know, putting aside that it's called ECW, just the idea of a third brand? Were they doing the best they could with it? Graham, your opinion, in 2007, what was the best use for ECW?
I think in the cable universe, they were probably doing the best they could for it. They were using it as a developmental. They were using it to test out new characters and to test out guys who maybe weren't ready for Raw and SmackDown. And from that, we got some fresh faces. We got guys like Elijah Burke. We got guys like CM Punk. We got guys like Kevin Thorne. And so it introduced all these new platforms for these guys to work. And the good ones got past it and moved on to other things, and the bad ones stayed right where they were. Mm-hmm. But at the very least, it gave these guys another avenue to work on.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Dan, how familiar with you? Did you miss most of the WWE CW run?
Yeah, pretty much. It was pretty much the lights were turned out by the time I got back in. And then they were starting to put more of an emphasis on NXT.
Right.
Starting with the reality-based show. My impressions just from watching some of these pay-per-views is that it already is watering down a pretty thin roster to begin with. Because you miss out on a lot of guys. Like some of the names that were just mentioned there by Graham was some of the names that, you know, were probably like what you were talking about earlier, guys who just sort of came and went and disappeared.
Sure. Never
and, you know, there's always a certain level of like the mid to undercard on Raw that you don't see too often. And the same could be said about SmackDown. And a lot of people just, that's what they do. They watch Raw. They don't necessarily watch SmackDown. They rely on Raw to give you some SmackDown highlights. So then now throw in a third show that if you're not watching SmackDown regularly and you're only watching Raw, then chances are you're also not watching ECW. There's probably a ton of guys that, you know, you just never really saw. They just slipped through the cracks. And it was the people in the world like Punk who aspired for better that wound up making names for themselves. But yeah, it's funny how it works because during these times, rewatching some of these pay-per-views, it's like, well, we're going to get out a third announce table for ECW. We're only going to really go to them once during the entire card, and then the table's going to get destroyed in another match that's more important. That's kind of my impressions from this time period.
Very astute. Glenn, do you have any final thoughts on Lashley, Kennedy, ECW, any of this stuff before we move on?
Well, this was really the time of transition, one time of transition for ECW. This was a couple months removed from December to Dismember, which kind of was the last nail in. I think that might have been actually the first nail in the coffin of the idea that ECW would be viable in the long term as its own brand, as it was, as a revival of ECW and trying to do like an actual third brand with it. At this point in 2007, we still have a bunch of the, you know, ECW originals running around. They were about to do that tag match at WrestleMania. You also have Punk starting to come up, starting to be a little bit of the vision of what ECW would become. But it wasn't great TV at this point. It would become great TV. ECW, I think, was the most entertaining wrestling show of the three in 2008, 9, 10.
I agree 100%. Yeah.
Definitely in 2009 and 10, by the time they got Christian in there as sort of the anchor, but they were trying to find that veteran who would be the anchor of the ECW brand. When it started in 2006, it was going to be RVD, and that lasted very briefly. Then it was Big Show, and then, you know, that went the way that it went, and then they made it the Bobby Lashley Show, and it was just Bobby Lashley feuding with Test and Hardcore Holly and other, you know, guys that they brought back like Test who were still kind of tired, and guys that they randomly moved over, like Hardcore Holly. And so that wasn't really a viable model, again, trying to do the whole Bobby Lashley push. After WrestleMania and after Backlash, when they moved the ECW title off of Lashley and they started moving people in and out of the brand, you can talk about that. That's a whole other topic because they were trying to find their veteran to anchor the brand in the summer of 2007, and obviously that didn't work.
Yeah.
So it was still in transition. It wasn't really. It was obvious that what it was could not continue.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really clear yet at this point what it would become.
Yeah, I think we'll definitely. Hopefully in some of these series, revisit some of the other 2008, 2009 stuff when the ECW really started to pop. Because I agree with you, that era where Christian and Tommy Dreamer and that crew, Finley, Mark Henry, when they were anchoring it, it definitely got a lot better. But that is for another time. For this time, I am now settling in, getting ready, looking at how much time there is left on the pay-per-view on the WWE Network. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is going to be a good 40-minute main event. This is crazy. You know, you got these big stars. We're all set to go. And then the last person I expected to see, babyface Mike Mizanin, comes strutting on out with his faux hawk, with his bizarre... Ooh, yeah, his hoorah catchphrase. For those of you who have never experienced babyface Miz in his most initial incarnations, you know, watch this pay-per-view for that, if nothing else, for that and for the midget match. Miz comes out to host a diva talent show. And I haven't talked a lot about the crowd of this show because it's an L.A. crowd. They're at the Staples Center. And L.A. crowds are a little notoriously quiet. But certainly... this did not wake them up. To run down quickly, we had Extreme Exposé, who you could tell this was definitely not the PG era yet, because there was probably one full outfit between the three of them, between Brooke, Kelly, and Layla, come out and do a dance. It's quickly obvious that Layla and Brooke are trained dancers and Kelly not so much. We get Jillian Hall coming out to sing, who she... for whatever she could or could not do, she could get heat as a heel. Then they just kind of throw the concept out the window. Candice Michelle, Maria, and Ariel come out, the No Big Schmaz. And then Ashley Massaro comes out to little to no reaction, unveils her Playboy cover, and then pulls a Sable Summer of 1998 and reveals she's wearing just a bottom and Playboy pasties on her breasts. Maybe my audio was wrong. It seemed like the crowd certainly could not care about any of this. Dan McGinn, don't know how familiar you were with the divas of this era. Please, your thoughts and your in-depth analysis of this segment.
Well, I kind of wish the divas were like this now, to be honest with you. I might be able to get through a segment on Raw if they did more of this sort of thing. Now. No, it was just TNA, just to kind of, you know, get people who've been watching dudes grapple all day something else to look at, I think. Miz, I was surprised Miz was in the company at this point. That was the other big revelation during this time period. You know, Layla, like Kelly, so these are names that I know of and I've seen before, but they were much younger, much hotter. You know, we got some Maria Kanellis in there as well. I mean, it was just you know, a TNA fest, and in a good way, a TNA fest. It was, you know, fantastic viewing. I don't know if I can eloquently talk about this the way that Glenn did about Little Bastard and, you know, Little Boogeyman, but it was fantastic in my eyes.
Well, Glenn, as someone who, you know, is up on pop culture and, you know, music and the arts and everything else, who did you have ahead in this competition when it came to a premature halt?
I think I had Layla up on points.
Okay.
This is the sort of crap they did all the time in this era. You know, they had the bikini contests and they had... All this sort of stuff that's just there so creepers can gawk at women. It's junk. It's bad. It's not anything I'm really interested in seeing. And then they have a talent show, which, you know, you have Extreme Exposé dancing, fine. You have Jillian singing, that's fine. She gets heat. And then Ashley's talent is, what, having boobs?
And not even her own.
It's quite a talent.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll take your word for that.
As the token single guy on the panel, I can tell you that's talent right there.
Oh, I'm single as well, but okay.
Yeah. Dan, you were the guy that Glenn was referring to. You were the demographic he was talking about.
Oh, yes, the gawking, the leering, all of it. That segment was made for me.
Graham, can you class up this segment, and what are your thoughts on Babyface Miz?
Babyface Miz is so bad. He's kind of like the same character.
He was.
But now we just feel more comfortable booing him.
Yeah.
Whereas before he was, hey, I'm the Miz, hoorah, and we're supposed
to get by. Hoorah. I forgot about that. I forgot he tried to.
That's a good thing to forget about. That makes you a happier person later in life.
Yeah.
It's so bad. He's so bad at being a babyface that they have to turn him heel because already we all hate him. Like that's how good he is at being a babyface. We already hate him. The segment, okay. If you change the perspective, okay. So it's a talent show, mm-hmm. essentially, and Extreme Exposé can dance a little bit. Jillian can't. One of the three can dance a little bit. Jillian can't sing, and Ashley's talent is getting naked, and then all the other girls like to roll around in their underwear.
Mm-hmm.
You could kind of watch it now with some perspective and think, wait, is this an inside joke?
Yeah.
Is this the company saying, yes, we know these chicks are not talented whatsoever?
Yeah. But this is what they can do. It's very meta.
This is what they can do, and this is what you paid to see.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, so the payoff is the Playboy cover, and the payoff is her trying to be Sable circa 1998 by having the pasties, except no one cares about the payoff.
Yep.
And then you just spent like 10 minutes on this. You spent 10 minutes establishing this, and then you've got a payoff that no one cares about.
That sums it up pretty
well.
Good
job.
And I think we move on from that. Before we get to the main event, I said we're going to bring it up, and I think, you know, this is the time to talk about it.
Oh, God, here we go.
All night long, Crystal Marshall, future Crystal Lashley, I believe. And
in between there, Crystal Long.
Crystal Long, almost Crystal Long, yes. Has been our backstage interviewer du jour. I remember being a fan of Crystal at the time, and looking back, I don't know what happened. They're like, she's doing interviews with John Cena, with Shawn Michaels, with Batista, with Kennedy. It seems like she will ask a question and then just basically stand there as the guy is waiting for her to feed them a line. It happened like 3 or 4 times. She seems completely unaware of what they're saying, reacting with a smile, even if they said something mean, just very deer in the headlights. Was there a worse backstage interviewer than Crystal during this show? Glenn?
Well, none of the backstage interviewers they had in the 2000s have been good.
Right. But were they as actively bad as Crystal was during this show?
I'm trying to remember. There are a lot of the like low-level interviewers
mm-hmm.
who kind of cycled in and out anonymously. I don't remember anyone who was so awkward
mm-hmm.
in the way that Crystal is here, but that might just be a failure of memory. They had so many in the last, you know, 15, 20 years.
Yeah. Graham, what about in your pantheon? Where does Crystal place?
In her own section.
Her own circle of hell.
Her own, yes. When I was watching, she got better. She got better as the show progressed. But that, you know, the first couple interviews are just so bad. She starts asking John Cena about what it's going to be like to tag with his WrestleMania tag team partner. She actually says that.
Yep.
So Cena's in a tag match in Detroit.
Apparently.
And I think she gets to be so bad with Cena that he says, I know why you're shaking. I know why you're nervous. Because you don't know what's going to happen when all of this
Cena definitely tried to help her out. Cena was the only one.
So kudos to him for doing that.
Yeah, Shawn Michaels had no interest in helping her whatsoever.
But she there's the awkward pause in which she says, and here's Batista.
Yeah.
And she does that with everybody. And I do, okay, she from watching this, you kind of get the idea, okay, this is why they do pre-tapes now. I like the experience of the live interview because Then you've got the super over babyface saying something, and the crowd goes, yay! And so you've got that interaction there a little bit. And even when – I think when Kennedy's doing his interview, he goes, you hear that? The crowd's booing me.
Yeah.
So you, obviously you can't do that in a pre-tape. But, yeah, they – whoever's idea was to put Crystal on the mic, maybe it was Teddy Long's. I don't know.
That's what JBL would say.
It's just bad. It was just so bad.
Dan, again, as our resident gawker.
Yeah.
Was there any could you mute it and make it okay?
Well, yeah, the skeevy guy demographic over here. I give you two reasons why she was holding that microphone, and they both occur below her chin. But in all honesty, in watching this, I when I first watched the first interview, I was like, did this girl win a contest? Like, was this like...
She actually lost the contest.
Yeah,
she
really.
She's a Diva Search loser.
Yeah. And you're right. There was definitely moments where, like, depending upon who she was with, it sounded better than it actually was. But it was all bad. It was this... I could see getting away with on like some low production, you know, we don't really have a lot of people on staff, so we got to just kind of cut corners somewhere and maybe a little small indie promotion or if you're watching on YouTube or something like that. But this was WWE television, and it was like everybody had to know it was awful. Like, it was almost as if, well, we know it's going to be bad, but that's going to be the gimmick right here, is it's going to be so bad we're going to put it on and just go with it. I mean,
well, that's what they would do with Maria.
Yeah,
they kind of made a gimmick of she's not very bright, and she made it work. But yeah, Crystal, we've devoted enough time to Crystal. I'm glad we got it in there. I think it's something. It was the elephant in the room. And now we move on to the main event of the evening, and really the match that the whole show was sold on. I mean, we've talked about some gems here and there. But this was all based on the fact that we had John Cena and Shawn Michaels, who were set up to face each other at WrestleMania the next month. Cena was the WWE champion. Shawn Michaels had defeated Edge and Randy Orton in a triple threat match to earn a shot at Cena. They were also World Tag Team Champions, and they were going up against Batista, who was the world champion over on SmackDown, and The Undertaker, who was going to be challenging him. Taker had earned his title shot by winning the Royal Rumble, last eliminating Michaels. Once the two WrestleMania main events were established, which they were pretty early on in February, Vince McMahon made this match as a match we had never seen before, never will again. And really the story is you've got two sets of opponents teaming up. They both want to win for bragging rights, but can they trust each other? Can Cena trust Michaels, who has turned on everybody? Batista and Taker, they had teased a lot of dissension between them. Leading up to this, you had a lot of cool singles matches and a lot of attacks. You know, you had all the different pairings, Cena against Batista, Taker against Michaels, Michaels against Batista, Taker against Cena. It was cool stuff. This felt like a huge match. It goes 22 minutes. It's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. I like that Taker and Batista do a lot of cool big guy monster tag team stuff. Cena and HBK function as more of a team. And a little way through the match, you know, they're all ostensibly baby faces, but Cena and HBK do kind of settle into the heel role. You got to see a lot of cool matchups, especially Cena Undertaker, which at this point we hadn't seen in a few years, and definitely not since Cena had become a big star. To me, that was the big tease. But we got to see them all go at it. Batista gets busted open. Not sure if it was intentional or not. Didn't look intentional. Looked like he hit a gusher on his eye. And the finish comes after 20-plus minutes when Cena is set up by Undertaker for a choke slam, and Batista turns on Taker, kind of out of nowhere. Nails him with a spine buster. HBK hits Taker with a Sweet Chin Music, and then Cena Fs you Taker for the win. We go off the air with Batista and Taker doing the stare down, getting ready for WrestleMania. A lot of stuff to talk about in this match, but first of all, general overall impressions of the match. Did it live up to the names? Also worth noting, Michael Cole at this point is basically a non-factor. JBL pretty much calls this by himself, which is very impressive. But Graham, what did you think of the match overall? Did it make the show worth it on this match alone?
Yeah, it did. It had a big fight feel. And I think at this point, you have to find out a way to make this pay-per-view mean something when your WrestleMania main events are set. There are no world title challengers on the show aside from, you know, Kennedy, and that's arguable. So you've got Michaels and Cena, you've got Batista and Undertaker. How do you set them up for WrestleMania without giving the champions kind of like a, you know, a throwaway match or something, like a, some kind of stupid title defense? How do you make that work? How do you keep the momentum going? And I thought the way they set this up kind of overcame that hurdle. I think at this point we have become so used to every pay-per-view has a title match. And so in lieu of that, I think they did a really good job of making this match feel big. I thought the match itself was fine. You've got your four biggest baby faces in the same match, but this giant ball of tension was in the air about who was going to turn on who. And I thought that really helped. I kind of feel like they've kind of put themselves in the same situation for Fastlane. The WrestleMania match is quote unquote set or whatever, but we've got our two big baby faces, and what's going to happen there? And I think there's a little similarity there.
Yeah, for sure. Dan, viewing this match for the first time, having not seen the build and the shows before and after, what did you think? What did you come away from it with?
Well, I just thought it was cool because there was really no downtime in this match, because regardless of who was in the ring, you had a really cool matchup. You had like two guys top of their game in their primes going at it, and you knew that going in that, well, Undertaker and Batista are going to be fighting next month, and same could be said for Michaels and Cena. But regardless of the combinations, it was kind of a match you wanted to see. You wanted to see Cena take on Batista because they kind of grew up together. They won their titles together. You know, at the time, it was probably a little bit fresher than it was in 2010, for let's say. Mm-hmm. Michaels and Batista, too, the big man, small man thing. Michaels bumping around like crazy. But then on the other side, he had kind of the dream matchup of Cena and Undertaker. And then you just saw a month earlier with Royal Rumble that Michaels and Undertaker could still go. Just a classic rivalry, classic feud. So you really, there wasn't a point where it was like downtime, where you were like, oh, well, there's not really much I want to see here. It's not like when you were watching like Warrior and Hogan take on Dino Bravo and Earthquake, and Dino Bravo got tagged in and you were like, oh, well, I don't care about this.
There were no Dino Bravos in this match.
No, absolutely. So you kind of felt like it was important. I like the aspect of doing something with both brands, because even though they were kind of clinging to it, it was still kind of neat to see the interactions of the main eventers from both sides going at it, but not necessarily throwing together like, well, you could have thrown somebody like, let's say, Booker versus Batista, for instance, you know, as like a quick feud. But really, the match we want to see is in Mania. So you kind of would book it so that Booker would lose because you knew there was not going to be a surprise. We knew going in. So in this case, you knew nobody was going to lose the belt. You knew there was nobody else to challenge for the belt. So in that aspect, it was actually really cool to see. And then. All match long, and I know we're going to get to the ending, and you've mentioned it already, but all match long, I was thinking what happened with Batista and Undertaker was actually going to happen with Cena and Michaels. Like, at any point, I was sitting there thinking to myself, okay, now when does Michaels just super kick Cena and then walk off? You know,
it's interesting you say that, Dan, because that was the prevailing thought at the time. That's what everyone thought was going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. They were teasing that constantly on Raw. They were doing this thing. It was pretty interesting. Once they established the Michael Cena match, they were frustrating expectations by not doing that each week. And some people actually thought they would never do it before WrestleMania. And then they finally did, like, at the very end of the last Raw before WrestleMania, they finally did it. But they really held off for a while before that. And Ben, I don't really agree that Cena and Michaels were playing the heels in this match. I think it might just seem that way because the Boo Birds were out for Cena. Because
no, but I'm not talking about
it's cool not to like. But
I'm not talking about crowd reaction though, Glenn. And you know, maybe I'm wrong, or maybe I else could say they weren't out and out, you know, heels, whatever. It's if you look at the stuff they were doing, they were the guys who. There's definitely a point where Michaels distracts the referee, so Cena can get some shots in on Undertaker from the outside. They're using subtle heel tactics. But if someone had to play the heel, they were definitely the ones who were, you know, taking advantage of the five count and stuff like that.
Well, I was thinking while I was watching that the only one of the three, as I saw it, that was really playing heel was Batista. He was the one who there was one point when the ref was distracted and he dropped Shawn Michaels on the steps outside. He was when he's doing his power offense, it's easy to see that as a heel offense. It's a pretty typical heel offense. It's one of the things that, you know, drives Batista as a face when he's doing it to heels. But in this match, when everybody's a face nominally, not according to the crowd, but that's another thing. But when he's doing it to Cena and Michaels, who are the best sellers of the four in the match as well, that came off to me like heel work.
Yeah. I think both are valid points. I mean, I don't think anyone can out-and-out heel in the match, but they definitely have things. I want to ask you guys this, because this is something that stood out to me, and this is more of a long-term question, and it's frustrated me for years and frustrated me watching this match. I cannot believe that they did not find some way, whether it was a WrestleMania 30, WrestleMania 25, any WrestleMania, that we never got to see John Cena against The Undertaker at WrestleMania. Particularly, you see here, they mesh so well. It really is the one dream match that I feel like we've never got, and at this point, Taker couldn't deliver. Was there any sense from any of you guys watching Cena and Taker in this match, kind of, because we would get all the other combinations at some point, but we never got Cena-Taker. I'll let you guys just jump in if anyone has a kind of thoughts on what could have been with Cena and Taker from this match.
Well, the problem with doing Cena-Undertaker is that they were both at this point so heavily identified with their respective shows. I mean, Undertaker was the one guy who never basically left SmackDown.
Yeah, once he got there.
Yeah, he really tethered that show. And then when Cena got to Raw, Raw was about Cena for several years at least. A big problem with doing Cena-Undertaker at WrestleMania is that Cena has to win as well.
Does he, though?
Yes.
What do you think, Graham?
I think it doesn't matter who wins. And the fact that they're on opposing brands just gives it more of an attraction feel. Right. These are guys that you aren't going to see wrestle on weekly television, nor should you, even if they are on the same brand.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, they had this altercation here. I think back in 2004. They had a TV, like a SmackDown match.
Yep.
And they had the big three-team tag at Madison Square Garden. They were on the same team. Yep. And then Taker hits the tombstone on him after the match. I think it could still be an option at some point. You know, obviously it wasn't going to happen in 07, even with this match, because WrestleMania was already kind of set in stone.
Right, I was more talking about, like, I always thought that should have been either at 25 or 30. I just think it was such a big match that was still on the table to me.
Yeah, and maybe it still is.
Maybe it is. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I agree. I kind of surprised it didn't happen, and it, watching, you know, and checking out all the different WrestleManias since this one, you would have thought that if it was going to happen, it would have. It definitely was a marquee match that they always seem to have in their back pocket, but then they just went with other guys. I mean, hindsight's 20/20, but yeah, maybe Michaels deserved two matches, but did Triple H really need two matches? And then, you know, CM Punk was...
Triple H didn't need either of those damn matches, but that's another subject.
Yeah,
it's not good. Glenn started.
Yeah, you know, Punk was you know, that was like his consolation prize when he got the chance to face Taker, and they made a good match out of it, and then of course they ended it with Lesnar. So it seemed like they had options. They might not have necessarily needed Cena as the face champion going into Mania every single time, but you know they. You know, they made their bed and they have to lay in it now. I mean, unless you wanted to try to get, and Jim Ross always talks about how Undertaker should give it a go this year if he can, and then retire next year. Well, the streak's now over, and he's not getting any younger, so I don't know when you're going to pull the trigger on it, if at all, and it's a chance that has come and gone, really.
Not to turn this into a WrestleMania rebooking show, which we can regather for some other time, but I...
Oh, we'll be doing that on the site anyway.
Yeah. Oh, great. All right. So to me, the great opportunity was always, I thought, WrestleMania 25, when, you know, we had the great Undertaker-Michaels match and then a bunch of other matches. I always thought that from the feud of 08, in a perfect world, Chris Jericho remains champion all the way to WrestleMania 25, defends against Shawn Michaels, and Cena goes against The Undertaker. That was always my two cents.
Ooh,
and
let's other have stuff. That. Let's go back in time.
Please.
I wish.
Yes.
I wish. You know, that's always been my kind of dream. But, yeah, that's definitely something I want to mention. All right, let's talk about the finish of this match. Because I'll be honest, I knew that the turn came. I remember, like Dan, when I was watching it in the moment, I figured it would be HBK Cena. I think what bothered me when it finally came and kind of marred a really good match for me was I knew they were going to do the turn at some point, but I know Justin has talked about this a bunch of times on the Regular Place to Be podcast. It's always frustrating when a guy, in this case Batista, you know, literally spends 20 minutes seeming like he's going to try to win the match and then costs himself the match. Because it's like, why didn't you just do that at the start of the match? And it's a hard thing to book, but it seems to me there should have been something as simple here as just like Undertaker didn't even nail him by mistake. That's the easy out here, is that Undertaker's throwing a clothesline Cena. Cena ducks. He nails Batista. Batista gets pissed. Spine bashes him out. What bothered me about this finish was that it came out of nowhere. It was they had spent 20 minutes trying to win this match. They have the advantage. They have their opponents on the run. And then Batista just decides, yeah, now's the time I'm going to hit a spinebuster on Undertaker. And the you know, JBL tries to sell it as, oh, he said he was going to get revenge on him because he chokeslammed him a few weeks ago. But, you know, why do the whole match then? And I'm curious for you guys how much it, if at all, spoiled the match for you. Should they have done it? Could they have gone another way? Dan, let's start with you. What did you think about the finish? And what was there another way to do it, or was this the way to go?
I mean, you could have just had them try to just win it outright, and then as it looks like, oh, well, look at them, they worked together, they got through their differences, and they hit each of their finishers on both their opponents, and everything is hunky-dory, and then wham, it happens at that point, you know, after the bell is rung, and it's like, well, yeah, you know, even though we've won tonight, you're still my opponent, your streak is still going to end, you're not taking this strap from me. See you later. That's one way you could have gone about it for sure. I mean, I kind of looked at it from maybe some naive eyes, but it certainly, I thought it was going to be the opposite, as I said earlier. It looked like, you know, things were too good to be true for the Cena Michaels side, that I expected something like that was going to happen. I just, you know, was kind of looking in one direction. That was all a red herring, because on the other side, that's where the real heat was. But I kind of like the closing segment, you know, with all the different false finishes, with all the different array of finishers being used. It kind of created a little bit of an interest and an excitement. And for a moment there, it looked pretty cool to have this kind of swank, dark SmackDown team just laying the lumber down on the other two pretty boys out there. Mm-hmm. And then for a moment, it's like, wow, Jesus, if these guys are enemies, think of what they would do if they were aligned. And then you got the trick ending there at the end. So, but it could have been done a little bit differently. But I think they were going for kind of a aha, gotcha moment, and they got it, at least out of me anyway.
Glenn, same question. What are your thoughts?
I got a somewhat different story from that. I thought as the match went on toward the ending, that Batista was getting a little sick of Undertaker showing him up.
Hmm.
Like he didn't want to make... He wanted to get in for the hot tag to take care of business. He didn't want... I think if he was going to win the match, he wanted to win the match. He didn't want Undertaker to be the one to win the match.
Yeah.
Because I think he said in his interview with Crystal, I mean, it's hard to remember any interview with Crystal, really, but, you know, he wasn't scared of The Undertaker. And I think that was, right. And I think that was like an insecurity of Batista's character coming into WrestleMania with The Undertaker, as it is so many times. Plus, the one guy out of the four who could most afford to take a loss there is Undertaker, because he's bulletproof at WrestleMania, at this point at least. So I think it was really pride on Batista's part, that as much as he wanted to win the match because it's a match that he's in, he doesn't want Undertaker to look good doing it.
Right. It's an interesting point, Glenn, and I think that is probably the story they were trying to tell. I think it, and this could be a function of the fact that, you know, their play-by-play guy was basically taken out of the equation.
True.
I didn't get that story, but it's definitely it definitely makes the most sense. Graham, just to kind of put a bow on this match, what did you think of the finish, and is there anything you would have done differently?
Well, I thought the finish was kind of, from one team or the other, what we expected.
Sure.
And the fact that it came out of nowhere, I mean, it kind of did and it kind of didn't, because we knew someone was going to do it. What it kind of reminded me of, you were saying, came out of nowhere, you know, no foundation maybe for it. One of the best heel turns ever, and I've heard this from many people and I tend to agree, is when Barry Windham turned on Lex Luger against the Horsemen. And this was in the middle of like a 25-minute tag team title match. Both guys are trying to beat the Horsemen. Everyone's sweating. They're all about exhausted. And then out of nowhere, bam, Barry turns on Luger, new champs, Barry's a Horseman. So if you can make that work, I have no argument with this.
Yeah. The only thing I remember differently about that one, correct me if I'm wrong, is I just remember, and I remember distinctly, JJ being out basically in Wyndham's ear the whole time.
He was
squawking at him.
There were a few weeks there beforehand
where
even Flair was saying, hey, Barry Windham, come on board, blah, blah, blah. But the actual turn itself in the context of that match, you know, why would you fight for 25 minutes? You're the champion. And then all of a sudden, no more.
Right.
You know, if you can make that work and tell that story, I think this works fine.
Fair enough. All right, guys, as we bring this to a close, we've had a good time here talking about midgets and Crystal and Miz and, you know, this match. But I want to ask a couple lightning round table questions on the show itself, on the era, and get your kind of quick takes before we close things out. The first of those is, as we noted, this is the last brand exclusive pay-per-view. This was a SmackDown pay-per-view, but as we went through, you know, you had a lot of people from ECW, including Lashley, you had people from Raw. Was it time to end the brand extension, at least on pay-per-view, or could they have gone longer doing these brand exclusive pay-per-views? Glenn, let's start with you. Yes or no on keeping the brands exclusive following this show?
Aesthetically, I might have preferred it, but logistically, I just don't see it. We mentioned when we were talking about the tag match how much the tag team division on SmackDown collapsed later in 2007, and it would have required some investment of roster spaces and resources to kind of bolster that up and keep a viable division to have a slot on future SmackDown pay-per-views, which wasn't something that they were really interested in doing, as much as I personally might have liked to see it, because, you know, it might have extended Lundrick's run a little bit. The cruiserweight division, too, I think was kept around as long as it was because it was supposed to be, at least, one of those draws for the SmackDown exclusive pay-per-views. So that would have needed, you know, some investment, too, to keep it a viable part of those shows. And you can see after the branded pay-per-views ended, when suddenly every month's pay-per-view had two world title matches, you know, even the ones that were former SmackDown pay-per-views. I mean, they had John Cena on top. They had Undertaker, or were supposed to. You know, they had all the stars for all the shows, so they could let some of the mid-card and undercard divisions and feuds kind of wither a little bit. So it would have required a lot of effort to maintain all that stuff, mm-hmm. as they had tried, at least, I suppose, to maintain it through 05-06. So logistically, I just don't see it happening.
Graham, same question.
I was a fan of it in theory, and I'm still a fan of it today in theory, because it gives a lot of guys who otherwise would not get that spotlight a little bit more television time. And I think in this era, they could probably get away with it more because they're not trying to leverage lower mid-card guys with trying to sell you on getting a pay-per-view for $40 or $50. For $9.99, you can watch a SmackDown pay-per-view this week or a Raw pay-per-view, and you're not shelling out as much money, and you might be getting more more of a this kind of show style. And here's in theory, I'm a big fan of the brand extension because it's not the same guys on Raw and SmackDown in the main event every week.
Mm-hmm.
At variety. And I think that's good in any year if you've got the lower card guys they can fill those spots.
All right, Dan, close us out on this question.
Just for the reasons we talked about before, I just think the roster was really watered down. There's a lot of stuff that you really probably didn't want to see in places, and I think this show was helped out by the fact that elements from ECW and Raw were on it. It made the show a little bit deeper, kind of spreaded it out a little bit. Whereas mm-hmm. I'm not as familiar with the product at this time, but I just have a feeling if you took out those elements and this was just SmackDown, you had Batista in a title match that you know it was a foregone conclusion he was going to win, or Undertaker in a just a random match that you knew he was going to win, it just wouldn't have done anybody any favors. And I think it's an idea that's time has come. Back in the day when it seemed like they had all the talent in the world, yeah, sure, you could spread it out a little bit. You know, when Heyman was writing for the show, and SmackDown was really a viable alternative to what you were seeing on Raw every Monday, yeah, you could get away with it. But I don't think at this point, with the lack of talent, that you could really make it work for you and make money off of it, and the buy rates probably showed it.
Yeah, I think we're at a consensus. I think as always, the idea of brand extension to me is always fun, but like Glenn Fred said from the start, you know, logistics are what hold it back. All right, one more question before we go. We'll snake it back around and start with Dan here, and that is essentially you have three ways that February pay-per-views have been handled over the years. Obviously, the Elimination Chamber was the one used for the past 8 years. Fastlane, the concept of the title shot being up in some sort of singles match, that's something they've done before. And then you have what we just watched, which is some sort of tag match involving the WrestleMania main event participants. Of those three options, starting with Dan, what do you think is most entertaining and also just the best in terms of storytelling to use for the February pay-per-view model?
I'm a big fan, actually, of what we just watched, to be mm-hmm. honest. I like the way the main event was set up. I mean, maybe don't do it all the time, but this kind of had like an early SummerSlam feel to it.
Sure.
You had like two big guys on one show versus two big guys on the other show. All of them main eventers. All of them you could see, you know, hoisting the belt at WrestleMania by night's end. It really put an emphasis on winning that Royal Rumble. I think when you put something else, another big show on the line between Mania and the Rumble, it's kind of like, well, why did we just do the Rumble then if he's just going to get thrown into a cage?
Yeah, yeah.
1 month later and he could potentially lose it. You know, I think there was also kind of that feeling of, well, even though even though somebody else is the champion here at the Rumble, doesn't mean that they're going to be champion at Mania. So I don't know. I kind of like the idea of knowing what the road to WrestleMania will eventually lead to, but you got to give me something to kind of get me to watch in February as well. Otherwise, I'm just going to turn you off for the next 6 weeks.
Yeah,
so,
it's going to be a novelty.
Yeah, so I really liked how this show did it, to be honest. I think that you still kind of had a look. They sowed the seeds that maybe Cena and Michaels would attack one another, and then you also had the feud with Batista and Undertaker, and it gave me reason to see what was going to happen and how these two would work together and this and that. Yeah, I don't know if you could do this every year, but I like this model more so than the other two.
For sure. Graham, what do you think?
I would always prefer this over gimmick for gimmick's sake. And while the Elimination Chamber is fun, it's gimmick for gimmick's sake.
Yeah, especially in February.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And a lot of those shows, you can go back now and look, and you know these guys have no issues with each other going into the show. Yeah. They just want a belt. And you know, I can go to a department store and get a belt. So I like this because it felt natural. It gave these guys some character development. You know what the payoff is going to be at WrestleMania. You just don't know how they're going to get there. And I'm always a fan of give me the WrestleMania main event at the end of the Rumble so I know what the next 6 weeks or 2 months are going to be like. And then between now and then, make me care about it. Yeah. And that's what this show did. It made me care about it. I think Fastlane will be fun, but as we all know, we don't exactly know what the WrestleMania main event is going to be right now. So I don't like that guessing in February. I think it's always more fun where you know where you're going. You just don't know what the bumps are going to be along the way.
Well put. Glennie Bunn, take us out.
That Graham, you really did put that well, and I agree. The problem with doing the Elimination Chambers in February, even though a lot of the matches were good, as late as 2012 with Daniel Bryan and Santino in the chamber, that was an excellent section of that match, and there were so many different opportunities to see different people square off. But the problem with doing it in February and every February is that it tends to uphold the status quo. You have the champion going in who, you know, is probably still going to be the champion at WrestleMania, unless it's obvious that they just need to get it to someone else to make the stories work. You have the title shot on the line where you know probably who they're going to position for the title match at WrestleMania. I mean, as much as it was fun to have Finlay in one of the SmackDown chambers, I don't even remember what year that was. It might have been 2008. Probably was, actually. He wasn't there later than that. Yeah, but was he?
He was definitely in multiple chambers. I don't know if it was always SmackDown.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen some of them. Yeah. But there was a year where, you know, Finlay was in the chamber, and that was fun, and Big Daddy V was in the chamber, and that was, you know, that was fine. But you know they're probably not getting a WrestleMania title shot, as fun as it is to have them in the match. So they tend to uphold the status quo a little bit, which you don't really want when you have sort of a wild six-man match like that. So it's an issue. At the same time, I think Graham put very well the problems with putting the title shot, one at the Rumble, up, because the Rumble is a major, major match, and you want that to matter. And that is a big issue with that. So I think by process of elimination, we arrive at the tag match like we have here, which was best with, or easiest to put together, I should say, when there were the two world titles. But
not impossible.
You could still do it though, because you still have major matches going on at WrestleMania, or at least you should.
But I think Dan made the good point of it's the early SummerSlam model. It's WrestleMania is when you have your big title match. SummerSlam is when you had some sort of marquee tag match, and that's what you could do here. You know, establish a bunch of the WrestleMania feuds leading up, and then just pair a bunch of guys together. You know, have a multi-man match, especially where it's not even that's not necessarily the gimmick a lot of other places, but just have a blockbuster tag match and pair some guys who are going to be fighting each other, or put a bunch of guys on the same team. I think it definitely works, and I think that's what we're all saying here.
Well, question for you guys. Does the match sell? Could you do that match now You've got the main event of a quote-unquote pay-per-view. It's a tag match. No titles are on the line. We're just going to grab some marquee guys, put them in a tag match. There's your main event. Does that, on paper, draw the interest that you need?
Probably not.
I think the mechanism of selling the show is a little different now that it's on the network.
Yeah. But putting that aside, just what Graham's saying as far as it being, you know, imagining the fact that we do want to get people to tune into the show. I agree. You know, we see tag matches every week. I think that's why you need to do – it's got to be something really special. You got to put together names you're not normally going to see. This year, I don't even know what I would necessarily do with this, unless it's the idea of seeing Brock team with something.
Oh, I'll tell you what would be great. It obviously couldn't work, but what would be fantastic would be a Brian Reigns, Brock, and Rollins tag match.
Absolutely. Mm. I think that would sell easily. So it's possible.
Yeah, I think the problem that I have with this model nowadays is it seems like we get these matches every week anyway.
Sure.
I mean, the running joke back in the day when Teddy Long was running SmackDown was, Teddy's coming out, we're going to have a tag match. And that's basically, we've seen all the different combinations of the top guys now that, you know, unless Brock is entered into the equation because he's a part-timer, then you really don't have a selling point because you wouldn't, like, if you ran Reigns and Cena versus, well, I mean, this would never happen, but if you ran Reigns and Cena versus Bryan and Rollins, yeah, it might be a fun, entertaining match, but I'm not sure it's going to be, let's make sure we get the network for this. I mean, it's debatable, but we've probably seen all these different combinations already.
Yeah, true, definitely. You kind of need that underlying factor of can these two guys get along, and which is what they had here, and that's why it works. And I think you still need that today.
Yeah, and then it's just a matter of, is it a thing where you know every year that the WrestleMania champion is going to have to team up with the Royal Rumble winner?
Oh,
who do they team up against? Then it starts to get back into gimmick for the sake of gimmick. So it's a tough nut to crack. WWE pay-per-views are not easy. We will, by the time this show airs, we'll see how they did this year with Fastlane. But guys, I want to thank you for taking a look back at No Way Out 2007. A random show on the surface, but I think we got some good mileage out of. So for Glenn, for Graham, for Dan, this is Ben saying thank you for listening to this inaugural edition, in a way, of TTBN Rewind. And remember, be kind. Rewind. What do you think, guys? That work in the catchphrase?
Oh, I like it.
No worries.
All right. Money in the bank.
I'd like to close out the show with one of my favorite Michael Cole quotes ever.
DDT.
I see only angry faces. Afraid that could be you and me. Share this skin. We can know how we feel inside. Instead of going down an endless road, not knowing if we did or lied. Something's over.